cue Henry Mancini, please. It's 7 p.m. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 213th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to recordings of the previous 212 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com and look under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try and subscribe, only one email per day. It's free. And once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I am honored to have recently been appointed the first poet laureate for the town of Yorktown, New York, and I am presently laying out my initial activities in this role. More news to come on subsequent shows. I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, to live, or as most do listen later, my guest next week will be novelist George Kramer. Now, to this week's show, the 213th, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756, and that is 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is artist, curator, and assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Sarah G. Sharp. I first met Sarah, and only online, when we were both adjunct professors at Purchase College of the State University of New York. She was teaching the course in new media, an interest of mine, and I thought that she would be a good guest for this show. And 4 or 5 years later, here she is. Good evening, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me.
Where did you first grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Northern California. I went to school in Napa, California, and I grew up in that area, Napa, Sonoma, Marin, where the recent fires were.
Oh, wow.
You might have heard of that.
Do you still have family in the area?
I do. A lot of my family is still there, and people were impacted in various ways from the fires, and I go back once or twice a year.
Did they lose anything, your immediate family?
I think no one lost anything serious. Everyone has the home that they live in intact. Some people were, you know, displaced and had to evacuate. So we're really lucky.
Wow. Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
I remember I always drew, and I always wanted to be an artist, but I came from a really working class family, and so in my family, wanting to be an artist meant that I would probably have to be an illustrator or like a greeting card illustrator. That was something my mom thought I could be. You know, they're very sort of practical and pragmatic about it. So I wasn't sure if that's exactly how I wanted to spend my time. So I also thought I might become a lawyer or I might be a writer. So I had lots of dreams. I wanted to do everything.
Well, that's good. Many of us do at that age. Where did you go to high school? Did you go locally?
I did. I went to a local public high school. It was in Napa, and it was called Vintage High School. And our mascot was a grape crusher because we were at the Up Valley Wine Country High School. And our colors were burgundy and gold, like wine and champagne.
Did you have any formal training as an artist while in high school? Did you do any artwork for the school paper or for the yearbook or any journals?
I did. I illustrated the cover of the literary journal that we published at the high school, and I went sort of as far as I could in the art classes there. And I had a really incredible art teacher who was named Mr. Gadberry, who had a pretty good career as a painter in the California painter scene. I was in high school in the late 80s and early 90s. And he got me sort of connected with taking drawing classes and going to a kind of art summer program. And he really sort of saw me as someone who needed extra resources and found those for me. And I think without him, I probably wouldn't have continued to pursue art in the way that I did.
That's terrific that you had that opportunity.
Yeah.
And then where to college and to study what?
I did a few things. I spent a year at the California College of Arts and Crafts, or that's what it was called then. It's now dropped the and crafts. So CCA, but at the time it was CCAC. And then I took some time off. I needed to work and make money. I couldn't afford to just go to college and have it paid for. And I ended up after that going to a school called the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, which was really, it's well known as a kind of interdisciplinary program. There's no grades. And I studied media stuff there. I continued with art. I did printmaking and painting, but I studied film and video there primarily.
The media studies is often an elusive term for many. Would you define it for us?
Sure. Well, I think it's a very broad thing. You know, I studied film history and the kind of social, political, and formal effects of media when I was an undergrad. So I think, you know, media studies as like a field really maybe started to solidify in the 60s and 70s and came out of all these other fields, you know, literary analysis and semiotics and sociology all sort of combined to think about the effects of media. So I think that's probably why it overlaps with a bunch of other areas. Later in the sort of areas I teach in, I have taught in really traditional media studies programs that are like communications degrees or move you towards a communications degree that really talk about popular media like television, magazines, the history of magazines and the internet now and film. But I have also spent a lot of time, you mentioned I taught in the new media program at SUNY Purchase, in thinking about new media forms. So I know I didn't give you a clear definition, but I think it, you know, it's a flexible area where we look at how media operates in culture.
That's fine. My son who's a screenwriter, went to NYU's to School of the Arts, and when they say School of the Arts, it had all sorts of things under it. You had to define what it was. There was radio and television. There was all sorts of things. And
yeah.
He was in LA for a number of years. Now he's just north of San Francisco. And in addition to his own writing, he's he's the game developer for Telltale Games.
Right. It encompasses all media. Where can I ask where in north of San Francisco he's living? Just curious about.
Give me
like
some of the sand. What?
Marin or Santa Rosa or Sonoma or.
Santa Rosa. San Rafael, my wife says.
Oh, San Rafael. Oh, great. Okay, wonderful.
So what came after college?
After I finished my undergraduate degree, I moved back to the Bay Area, and I worked for a time at the Academy of Art College managing their film program, like managing the equipment for students. And then I started working at Mills College as the media services specialist. So I was a staff person there, and I had a broad range of responsibilities. I set up mics for visiting artists and theorists to give their lectures, and I managed all the classroom stuff, and I worked with students, and it was great to be at Mills. It was a wonderful place. Go ahead.
Bring us up to purchase.
Okay, so then I moved to the East Coast went to an artist residency in Vermont called the Vermont Studio Center, and I ended up getting a job there. So I stayed there for 2 years and worked at the Studio Center. And while I was there, I applied to graduate schools, and I ended up going to grad school at SUNY Purchase.
Do you have two graduate degrees from SUNY Purchase, both awarded in the same year? Would you explain that to us, how you did that?
Sure. The new media department at Purchase just started a graduate program, but it wasn't there when I was there. I went into their regular MFA studio art program, so I have a master's in fine art. And they have Purchase doesn't grant PhDs, but they do have several other master's programs, and one of them is a master's program essentially in art history, and you can kind of combine classes and complete both degrees in 3 years if you're accepted into the MFA program. So I did that. I did both of those degrees together in 3 years.
Now, the MFA, as I understand it, is a terminal degree, as you mentioned. There is no PhD in your field.
That's right.
You're at the same level as a PhD would be in history or in computer science or whatever. Even while in grad school, you were busy writing and exhibiting, work you continue to this day. So let's start with the exhibitions. How would you describe your art, particularly to someone with a poor background in art?
A lot of the work I make now, I use textiles. I do some print-based work, which would be images that I construct digitally and then print out. And I also use found media, and I've been sewing into the work I make. When I was in grad school at Purchase, I wasn't sewing, but I was making sculpture that would sometimes include either domestic materials or soft materials. So, and I also made sort of video and animation work and drawing. So I've always worked across all kinds of media. And I am really interested in like communal spaces and people that are interested in producing their own societies. We have such a long and complicated history of that in America. So that's been a thing that I return to in terms of my subject matter. And I'm also really interested in how that idea of kind of heading off and starting your own new community interfaces with our feelings about land and landscape in America. So like landscape and our kinds of feelings about whether we have a right to do whatever we want or how much it might sort of going out into the wilderness equals some kind of like pure experience. Those are all things that I think about when I'm researching materials for my work.
I I belong to the Hudson Valley Writers Center, which is a wonderful place for writers and all this, and I go to open mics there, but they have an artist in at the open mic in different disciplines, and I had never seen anything like this artist whose work was they did wood, and then they seemed to make it part of an artwork with the theme. I've never seen anything like it, and I'm not describing it well, but it blew me away. You know,
interesting. They used wood, and it was like marquetry, like they cut into it, or
they cut into it, and they designed it, and then it became part of the work, with some theme that explained it. And there was poetry on the side. There was their own words, and it was their own design with the wood. There was a term for it. If I go back to it, I'll send it to you.
Okay, great.
The first exhibitions I see in your bio were in 2002 in Oakland and in San Paulo. How did these come apart?
Well, that was just after I graduated in 1999 from Evergreen and went back down to Oakland. So I, when I left Evergreen, even though I had studied film and video, and I had jobs doing sort of film and video related stuff at the Academy of Art College and Mills, in my own studio, I just wanted to paint. So I had a studio, I painted, I did printmaking, and I did my best to, like, as a young artist, just getting out of college to show as much as possible. So I think one of the first juried shows, which was at the Pro Arts Gallery, I just applied for it, and I got into the show, which was great. And then that connected me with some local curators, and the show in San Pablo was a three-person show because I had met this curator through the Pro Arts Gallery, and she put together a small show, which was, you know, wonderful to, as a young artist, to get that kind of exposure and experience.
Then in 2004, you did one in New York, and you also did one in Vermont. I assume that was part of the residency we're talking about. And that was the solo exhibition. How did they come apart?
I did the residency and then stayed in Vermont. I was there from 2003 to 2005. So the Vermont Studio Center is a residency center in a really small town called Johnson. Writers can go too. You might look into it if you're interested in doing a residency. And they have a lot of people there, like 30 or more people a month come through. So I got to know a lot of different artists and writers. And as a staff person, they have a beautiful gallery, and you got to have a solo show. So I was able to have a solo show on the kind of campus of the Studio Center. And then I met some people, and one of the people that I met, Ethelyn Honig, was a member at 55 Mercer Gallery in Soho, and she, instead of, which is a collective, you know, it's one of the old New York collective galleries where the artists got together and pay for the space instead of, as a way to, like, subvert the gallery system. And as part of that process, all of the members get to have one show a year or every other year, however it works out. And so instead of that year, instead of having her own solo show, she wanted to curate a group show from some of the people she'd met at the Studio Center. So I was in that show, which was also a wonderful opportunity. That was really fun.
Since then, you've exhibited every year, often twice in the same year, but up until this year, when you've been involved in three exhibitions, two in Baltimore, mm-hmm. and one in Brooklyn. How are you able to keep up such a busy schedule with all of your writing and teaching work?
I don't know. I've had a particularly busy 3 months, and I really you know, I could use a vacation. It's really, you know, time management. I would say it's actually the hardest thing. I would say I constantly struggle with it, and yet I move forward, you know. And I think I also, if I'm doing one thing for too long, I get a little bored. So having a couple of things going on at once and getting to sort of jump from thinking about curating, planning my class, working in my own studio, it helps me approach everything, you know, with a kind of fresh energy. So it's, I think it's actually quite important to me that I have multiple things going on at once. But yes, I can get a little overextended.
So you have no concerns about burning out in any particular area then?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing about teaching, you know, on one hand, it's so deeply time consuming. When you're a full-time professor, I'm really committed to teaching, so I want to give as much energy as I possibly can to my students. But when you're a full-time professor, you also have to, you know, be on committees and do other kind of service for the department, and it's quite intense during the semester. But then you get a pretty good, you know, you get a couple of weeks off in the winter to really return to your research. And if you're an art professor, your research is your studio work. And the same for the summer. So I feel like, luckily, I have a job that supports the other things that I'm doing. And yes, I sometimes feel like I'm going to burn out. But I also feel just really lucky that I have a job that, as I said, kind of supports what I'm doing with my artwork and curating and writing.
Now, in other disciplines, do you hear the expression publish or perish when you're going for tenure? Is your studio work and your exhibitions count as publishing in your field?
Yeah, and that's actually one of the challenges. I teach at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County, which is a research university, and it's wonderful. I feel very supported there. However, it's different than even, say, SUNY Purchase, which is kind of the arts college of the SUNY system. So there's a sort of understanding about what a career in the arts might be compared to traditional publishing practice in academia. At my university, there is maybe a little more work in terms of having to sort of explain what an equivalency in an art career might be to the publication of a book, for example, you know. But those things have been thought through by my department. So there's sort of a, you know, there's greater value given to a solo show. And I think in art, one of the complicated things is that sometimes, like an equivalency, like in academia, it's like most desirable that you're published in a peer-reviewed journal, which means that your peers review and say, yes, this is worthy of publication. But in art, in terms of reaching the broadest community and having the biggest impact, a juried show might not always be equivalent to like a peer-reviewed journal, you know. So there is a kind of like, as you're putting together, I just did my third year review packet, which is halfway to tenure. You have to kind of sort of explain what the impact of your work is, where, as you say, and you're totally right, in a more traditional academic area, the impact is really straightforward. It's a publication, it's in a peer-reviewed journal, or it's a book, et cetera.
Your exhibitions are too many to go into in detail tonight. Are there any in particular that you want to bring to our attention?
Well, I think, you know, I think I've been pretty lucky to be a part of many different exhibitions, and I think the ones that are most interesting to me are sometimes the exhibitions I curate, actually. You know, like I really I was lucky to put together a show at a gallery in Long Island City called Radiator, where I brought together artists that were all making things in the concrete world. You know, they were painting or making sculpture, but everything they were making was referring to or trying to work through our sort of digital social reality. So I'm really interested in those sort of intersections between what we make and touch every day and how our social spheres have changed because of the internet. Like, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation without social media, probably. So, I mean, hopefully we would have found each other. But so, what I really get excited about are sort of curating things and bringing together other artists and the ways in which I could potentially create a platform for discussion. I recently completed a project called Toolbook that was a fundraiser for various groups to kind of, it's something that I came up with after the election as a way to sort of get artists and writers to feel like they can be empowered to just directly do something. And then it's this great book where you can, you know, there are 43 artists in it and people shared things that inspire them along with their own work and writing. So, you know, I'm really excited about and interested in having a really multidisciplinary way of, you know, being in the world, I guess.
That sounds terrific. If there's a URL on that particular one, I'd love to have you send it to me. I'll put it in the article, and I'll look at it.
Wonderful. Great. Yes, Great.
I was going to get into curation because along with your exhibition, you have moved into curation with five products in the last 8 years. What exactly is involved in the curational project, and how does one get involved in such work?
Well, I think the first show that I curated a few things like group exhibitions at a cafe or a one-day pop-up kind of thing. But then the first sort of really serious show I curated was the one I mentioned at Radiator Gallery. And I think, you know, part of the way I got to curate was because I knew some gallerists and other artists just like from being an artist. And I knew that this gallery would take a proposal. So, and that was the show, it was called Offline at Radiator. So that was great. And I realized, you know, as an artist in New York, you just know a lot of other artists. So it was very exciting to think about how all this work might show together and to have no real, I mean, it would be great to sell things, right? But I didn't like have to sell to be able to put this show together. So it was really nice to just kind of get a bunch of people together whose work I really respected. They got to meet each other and, you know, we put a show up and it was, you know, a lot of work. It's a lot of editing and like getting postcards made and, you know, it's kind of administrative work, but it was really great and worth it in the end. And that made me think that I could curate other things and kind of continue to, I've heard, you know, people say that if an artist is a curator, that curatorial product is really about that artist's work, like recontextualizing it. And I think that's really true. It's a way to sort of, you know, make connections that might not be present with your work just alone. So after Radiator, I curated several shows for the Spring Break Art Show, which is a big, it's part of the Armory Week. And it's sort of well known in New York as like, you aren't charged to show, and they really encourage artists to curate, and they get these kind of weird spaces. You might have read about the first 2 years that I was in it, they were in the old post office building on 34th and 8th Avenue, the giant sort of, it's like a whole city block. It was like the anchor sort of post office for all of New York. And you know, all the mail now goes to like warehouses out in New Jersey. So it's like 80% empty. And they took over a little section of it, three floors, and we all got to curate a show in these old run down, like they had last been renovated in the early 60s. But, you know, this is a building that's like 100 years old, in these old sort of office spaces above this beautiful old post office. So that's been great to have a real public platform and to get to participate in that community.
I'm old enough to remember when that building was operable, and it was called the GPO, meaning General Post Office for New York.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, that neighborhood, because that was just below the old Madison Square Garden. And to show how the changes that it first dawned on me, I went to Iona College. We used to play a lot of basketball games in the old garden. And I was also a pro basketball fan and a hockey fan. Well, just up the block from that was the bar called O'Brien's. And O'Brien's, the night of any sports event, the people were three deep at the bar, and you'd be standing in the back, you'd be waving six beers back here, and they'd be passing them back. The day the old garden closed, they put the padlock on the door because the game was over. You know?
I've
seen that happen in so many places. When the General Motors plant closed in Tarrytown, people talked about the jobs that were lost. They didn't mention the delis and the gas stations that were all around it. They just went out of business.
Right.
You know?
The culture and small businesses. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
In 2016, you had projects in both New York City and in Baltimore. Are these the ones you've described to us, or are they other ones that you had last year?
Well, I did have I curated a screening in Baltimore, which was great. And then, I mean, that's the great thing about spending part of the week in Baltimore and getting to teach there and getting to know Baltimore, which is an incredible art place, incredible music, and a really complicated, beautiful, interesting city. I was able to curate a screening there. And then I was in a great show in Baltimore called Light City. It's like an event that goes on for a couple of weeks. A bunch of cities have it, where it usually happens like in the winter, and they sort of throughout the city have a bunch of different light-based exhibitions. And I got to show a video in Light City that was something that I had shot when I was doing a residency in Spain in, I think, 2011 or 2012. I was making work about different landscapes that looked like the landscape I grew up in. As I mentioned before, I was interested in like landscape in America, and I grew up in Northern California with access to a lot of dramatic mountains and Mediterranean climate. And I did a residency in Spain in the state of Almeria. And the park I was in, it was within a kind of sort of like a national park, looked just like the region that I grew up in Northern California. So I made a video about that, and that played at the Light City Festival in Baltimore in 2016.
I mentioned earlier that I first met you at Purchase, but you have since gone on to not only be a professor at the University of Maryland Baltimore campus, but also the member of the faculty at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. Could you describe your courses at both, and once again tell us how you're able to manage such a workload?
Sure. Well, I graduated from Purchase in 2008, and then about half a year later in 2009, I started teaching in the new media department as an adjunct. And then the following summer, so the summer of 2009, I started teaching in the art practice MFA program at SVA. I began teaching there 2 years later in 2011. So I Art practice is it's a low residency MFA program, and which means that the MFA students meet and are together intensely for about 2 months over the summer, and they're from all over the world, and then they return to their homes, wherever that may be. Some of them, of course, also live in New York, and they continue to communicate online. They take some academic courses online, and then they come back together the following summer. So I teach like a media intensive. So I get all of the first-year students, and we do a kind of time-based media course together very intensively for several weeks. And I've been part of that since the very first year that art practice started, so it's changed and grown, which has been really interesting. And I was a thesis mentor for one of the students, and I really try to participate in that program as much as possible because it's been a great experience for me. It was founded by David A. Ross, who was a well-known museum director and curator and part of, you know, he's been around, he lives in Beacon. So, yeah, it's been a great experience. So I have the summer off from teaching in Baltimore, but I spend a couple of weeks every summer with these grad students from SVA.
You're also the co-founder of Cohort, an artist collective. Just what is Cohort?
We started it, a couple of people that I went to grad school with and some other artists started it initially as a critique group. We would get together and every other week someone would present their work. And then we started curating shows from our group. And, it's essentially like a supportive place for artists who are trying to keep their practice going and make connections.
You mentioned earlier that in your high school and in college that you're into traditional drawing and painting, but since then you've moved into these other materials and any other textures. Do you still do any traditional painting?
I don't do any traditional painting. Painting for me, it's something I realized in grad school that it has so many years of just this kind of weight of tradition behind it, and it felt more exciting to me to try out other media, although I really loved painting. I painted for many years. But I think all of my painting and my interest in painting was about color and drawing, actually. So, I think some painters, their process and practice is really about the media of the paint. And that's not where my interest was. It was in forms and other things. So I say now that my practice is really rooted in drawing. And that got extended into sewing. I sew into collages and paper and found media, and I make textiles along with the other kind of work that I make.
All through your career, you've received scholarships, awards, grants, and residencies. Back to scholarship to purchase right through two residencies this year, one in New York and one in Mexico. And in 2010, as you mentioned, you received one to Spain. What are the products of such residencies?
Mm-hmm. They've actually been really important to me, especially you reflected how busy I seem, and that's true. It's quite hard during the semester when I have a full teaching load, and right now in teaching in Baltimore, I commute. It's hard to generate new work in the studio. So I've used residencies, and that was true before I was teaching in Baltimore. When I was teaching in New York, I was an adjunct not only at SUNY Purchase, but also at Baruch College. And then for a while, I was teaching at Parsons, Baruch, and Purchase. That's part of the reality of trying to be an artist and teach if you don't come from, if you don't have a lot of financial support elsewhere. You have to kind of cobble together all of these jobs and all these ways of working. So getting to do a residency is this incredible thing. And sometimes I don't, in the case of, for example, the residency I did in Spain in 2011, I didn't make that much work while I was there, but I shot a bunch of video and photos. I generated new ideas. It gave me time to kind of think and really look at what I was doing and give it some space and not be in a place where I had to hang a show and do a bunch of other things. I could just kind of really think about what I was making. And that kind of set me up for half a year to a year after that. I knew what I kind of needed to do in my studio. And of course, it changes and evolves as you start making things. But for me, doing a residency every other year or so, and ideally I would love to do one every year, lets me kind of think through and get some space. And then I sort of answer a lot of questions when I do a residency, I think, and I can take that information back into my daily life and my daily studio practice.
Well, and how in my field, the residencies tend to last about 2 weeks. How long is a traditional residency in art?
Anywhere from 2 weeks to like 2 months. I've mostly done residencies that are either that are from 2 weeks to a month long, because I haven't, you know, I usually haven't been able to take as much time off. For artists, because just sometimes the very process of making takes so much time, having a full month I think is pretty ideal. Although I did a 2 week residency in New Mexico last winter, and it was really fruitful for me. So, yeah, I think a little longer, just because you have to kind of set up all of your, you know, processes and materials, and things have to, like, dry sometimes, you know, like, it's a little different than writing, where maybe mentally you have to shift, you know, your materials are usually, like, a laptop, I'm guessing.
Over the years, you must have amassed quite a collection of your own work. All of my writing and broadcasting work can be stored on my computer. Where is your work resident?
Well, I have a studio right now in Bushwick, and I have some storage in my studio. But I do, you know, that's the beauty of making video and even digital print work, that the real... the work itself resides on a hard drive, and I can print the number of editions as needed. So, yeah, no, that's a real, and it's, you know, it's a specific, it's a different problem in New York than in other places. Like, you know, it's hard to have space here. I made a lot of big sculptural pieces in grad school that don't exist anymore, or I kept parts of them so that I could remake them. And I think that's also something that artists learn to do. Sometimes you have to remake a piece if it's needed again. So, yeah, I store what I can in my studio, but I don't have a very, I have a quite small studio. So, yeah.
Now, has your physical work that was shown in exhibition been for sale, or?
Yep. Yeah, it's always been for sale. Well, yes. Not always.
Okay.
I think sometimes there were pieces that I didn't want to sell, but generally now, yeah, everything's for sale. And I have work in a couple of different collections, so work resides in those places. And I have also given like larger paintings and things like that to friends. So, you know, my work is out in the world, not just stored up in my studio.
Terrific. What's next for you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I feel like I haven't been able to think past the next week for a couple of months. Right now I'm getting ready for work that's going to be at Art Basel Miami, which is coming up really soon. And I mentioned the Toolbook Project, which I'll send you a link for because I think it would be great to sort of get information about it out there. I'm curating another show in the Toolbook series where I'm working with another artist to curate a show of artists who've been affected by climate change. So we have an artist from Puerto Rico, a couple of artists from Houston, artists
wow.
from all over the world. And they're also, so we're having a show in New York, and then they're also making editions of objects. So we're going to make a kind of kit of, you can, you know, buy a kit. We're not sure how much it's going to cost yet. And all of that money will be donated to relief organizations. So just trying to find a way to keep making art and keep engaged, but directly give money to the things that we think are important and pressing right now.
Now, you'll be showing your own work in Miami?
Yes, yes.
And how does that work? You have to properly get it there, or do they arrange for it, or how do you,
well,
how does the whole thing work?
It's part of the Satellite Art Fair. So, you know, it's like the Armory Week in New York. There's the main art fair that's the Armory, and then there's a bunch of other little art fairs that pop up around it during that week, and Spring Break that I talked about is one of those in New York. So I'm going to be part of the Satellite Art Fair, which is one of these like ancillary shows that's not part of the main gigantic Art Basel show. But I think people really come to an art fair week and they get really interested in all the kind of outsider projects. And I'll be there. So you get brought in by, you can pay to have your own booth, or you can be brought in by like a gallery or an institution. And I luckily have people that are flying down there. And I mentioned before, I think, that I've been making textile work, so I can fold it up and they're just going to take it on the plane with them and install it for me. So I feel
Perfect.
Very lucky about that. Yeah. Yeah.
We've covered an awful lot tonight in a short time. We haven't even gotten into your extensive writing and lecturing. What else would you like the audience to know about Sarah G. Sharp? And what's the G?
Oh, the G stands for Grace. It's my middle name. It was also my grandmother's name, Grace Jordan. And there are several other artists named Sarah Sharp, including a well-known country singer in Austin, Texas. And they all have my URLs. So I have the G as my professional name so that you know how to find me. And
okay.
I don't know if I have anything else to tell you. I feel like I've said a lot about myself. So unless you have any other questions, I think we covered a lot.
But you also lecture all over on art. How do you manage to fit that in?
Well, that's one of the great things about having an academic job is that they support you doing that kind of stuff. So, and I've been lucky to be invited to come to various places, sometimes graduate programs, and talk about my work and meet with students. And that's really, you know, honestly, that's kind of the best part of it is getting to not necessarily talk about your own work. I enjoy that, but what I really enjoy is having an exchange with other people. I love meeting students and other artists and getting to, I mean, what a totally lucky life that you get to spend it talking about the ideas and things that interest you and that you love, you know? So that's the fun. It's so fun for me to get to travel and meet people and see what they're doing and have a studio visit with them and then talk about my work with them. I feel so lucky to get to do that.
You also have an extensive bibliography. So if you could send me, if that's on your website, be sure to send me that as the link so I can get it into the article that I'll be publishing.
Okay, great.
This. And thank you, Sarah. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's been so great talking with you, John. I really appreciate it.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I blogged at Medium.com, and I published the newspaper you mentioned earlier. Send any comments or questions to me on the show at johnmack13@gmail.com. Then once again, John Mack is JOHNMAC. And in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. On this Veterans Day weekend, I think we'll go off with a George M. Cohen song. So let's bring that up, please.